What a great start to the show. Good to be here, although, man, it is beautiful outside.
It is. But we got a lot to chop up today and talk about, including some stuff you've been working on. You're a federal defense attorney. You do whistleblower laws, too. You've been on the program for maybe 2 years now, Mike. You're one of our regulars.
Seems like a week, John, but it could be 2 years. Yeah.
Flying by. You sent me potential topics, number one, a scary development in the law. Ooh, you got me nervous. What are we talking about, Mike?
John, things have taken a really, you know, you would probably argue a bad turn because I'm in charge of deciding a case.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, sometimes in civil cases, the parties agree that they have to arbitrate the claim, right? So, for instance, an employment discrimination case or even in commercial disputes, the parties will have a contract that says, hey, the case has to be arbitrated, meaning you waive your right to trial, you waive your right to a jury trial. So I, in certain cases, have been selected by the parties to decide an arbitration.
So you're the judge,
through the American Arbitration Association. Yeah, so I wouldn't call myself judge, but I call myself arbitrator. But it was very interesting spending, you know, basically 2.5 full days this week being the arbitrator, hearing the evidence, you know, hearing the attorneys do all the work and trying to, you really feel like you got to listen so keenly, though.
How many of these have you done?
This is actually the first one that went to hearing.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So a lot of the times, you know, you get selected, you're the arbitrator, and then just like in real civil cases, oftentimes they settle.
Right.
So I've probably been appointed to 10 or so, and everyone has settled. So this is finally one that went the distance.
I know you're not a judge, and I know you're not a jury, but for all intents and purposes, the role of an arbitrator essentially is judge and jury, right?
Correct. It's a private, agreed-upon mechanism to decide a dispute.
Is it just you or is it a panel?
In this case, it's just me. I am the panel. So, yeah, sometimes...
That's why you have to pay attention to every word.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't get the benefit of the transcript. So, yeah, I was writing furiously. I was listening furiously. Plus, you have to rule on objections just like a judge would.
Oh, that's
but
so cool.
I did almost laugh out loud when a witness got on the phone and I said, good morning, and she said, Your Honor. I didn't correct her, but I did almost laugh, you know. But it was pretty funny.
How would I address you?
I'm the wrong guy. Hey, I don't know, arbitrator?
Sir? Or, probably just sir.
Sir? Yeah, whatever. But it was very interesting. The attorneys did a great job. I can't get into the case or what it's about, but I thought both attorneys did a fantastic job, and it was kind of fun to not be the one presenting. And I told them before closing arguments, you know, the best thing about the closing arguments today, and they kind of looked at me befuddled. I said, I don't have to do it. just not having that weight of that stress felt great.
I wonder if you will find doing this, if you work more of these, that you learn something about presentation from the other side as someone who looks on now as not the judge, but the arbitrator.
Absolutely. I mean, any case that you're intimately involved in, you always learn a lot and you always pick up something. So I definitely felt like I did in this case. And I thought two very contrasting styles. You know, the approach when you're representing a plaintiff is very different usually than when you're representing a defendant. And, you know, when you're representing a plaintiff, there's more attachment and tie to and pull at emotion and things like that. Mm-hmm. And the practicalness, if you represent a defendant, you know, you're trying to, you know, a defendant company, you're trying to put them in a good light of still being good citizens, trying to make decisions that are not based upon bias or retaliation. So I saw the approaches that I was familiar with. It's just been a while since I've been able to like sit back and you know, take it all in rather than do it.
Right. I imagine also it's about how do you present a case in a digestible way for a juror, because that's got to be one of the hardest things to do is that, you know, you as the defense attorney and the state, their attorneys, they know so much about the case, the ins and outs. But at the end of the day, these are like boring PowerPoint presentations, or they can be, and hours and hours and hours in the courtroom. Your presentation, that's such a key part of it.
Yeah, I mean, especially let's take a criminal case. So sometimes, yeah, the actions or issues that have to be decided by the jury are can be exciting, right? However, even in, you know, what you would term an exciting case, there's still a lot of routine to it, roteness, you know, in terms of the prosecution introducing evidence, laying the foundation to introduce evidence, getting into evidence things that seemingly to the jury might not matter, but they're an element of the case that the prosecution has to prove. So there's a lot of stuff that you do and you think about that the jury does not care about, and we are often misguided in our approach because we think, since we're so engrossed in the case, that certain things matter or certain things are very important, and oftentimes they turn out not to be. particularly if you talk, if you get the chance to talk to jurors, which is sometimes rare depending upon your jurisdiction, what they thought was important, and sometimes it just blows your mind.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because instead of like points A, B, C, D, E, F that I brought up, it's, I had a feeling. The vibe check is sometimes as important, or it's storytelling, right?
Yes, like, yes. I mean, it's the overall impression of the case, I think. And, you know, there's obviously certain pivotal things that'll turn on, but how that's presented and how that's argued can be the difference. And it could be the credibility of a certain witness. It could be the perception that someone's not credible.
Right.
Or the perception that some piece of evidence is super important that you really didn't think was important. You know?
That's interesting. It makes me wonder if we should just have AI juries.
Yeah, that would be scary.
Yeah, right? Yeah, well, but like actual robots that could, you know, consume every piece of data point that you present, the state presents, and put together a probability chart of guilty or not guilty and vote in that way, that would seem to be the fair way to do it, Mike.
Yeah, well, sadly, that's probably going to happen someday.
I hope.
But you know, the big difference is, and the thing that I don't think you can ever take out of a case is credibility determinations, right? However, you know, studies also show that people are very
bad at that
and ill-equipped to make credibility determinations, although they think they're very good at it, right?
Yeah, because it's a vibe check.
Yeah.
And who knows what created your biases for your vibe check.
Yeah.
People you've interacted in the past that have lied to you acting a certain way is not representative of anyone who would lie or be honest to you in the past, in the future.
Yeah, it could be your experience with your kid.
Right.
Or your experience of when you lied, right?
My 3-year-old puts his hands behind his back when he's nervous and lying.
Yeah.
So this guy must be nervous.
Or just
lying.
How the person dresses. Or
yeah.
You know nothing of their mannerisms or how they act normally. And you may think that a cue that they gave you based upon their mannerisms is a tell that they were telling the truth or not. But that may be just be some idiosyncrasy of
nerves.
That person that you don't know anything about, right? There's actually a good thing coming up. I think it's a documentary. I just saw it announced where they have, I think it's a murder trial and they're having two juries. It's like a televised thing. So I'm assuming it's not a real case.
Right.
But the point of the show or documentary is to show how random the jury system can be.
Mm.
And I learned about it through the guy that you had on the show one time. You had Jack Lawrence who does that podcast.
Yeah.
And he's an Australian. They don't have the jury system in Australia. And he's a big critic of it. Because, you know, he's been digging into a lot of cases that seem like they're wrongful convictions and may be wrongful convictions. And, you know, his takeaway as someone who's totally unfamiliar with our jury system is that essentially that it sucks, that it's so
that
random.
Juries are wrong.
Yeah,
that's the wrong way to do it.
That's his takeaway, like from him looking at all these cases from someone who doesn't have that system. Instead of saying, wow, what a great model, his takeaway is, wow, it doesn't work. It's so random.
Is it just people judges in Australia then?
Yeah. So they don't have a jury. They don't have a jury trial system. Yeah. And, you know, in other countries, you know, evidence is presented in very different ways. So our system is pretty unique.
Boy, that opens up a whole other line of conversations that I don't even know if we have time for today. But it does lead me to the ultimate question of defendants, should they request a bench trial instead of a jury trial?
Well, that comes with its set of, you know, potentially troublesome things too, because I mean, look, you know a pretty good amount about your judge's background, and I'm not to say that their background dictates how they decide a case, but clearly in the mind of a defense attorney, certain judges have a track record of being more favorable or a perception of being more favorable to defendants,
right?
And sometimes it may arise out of the fact that unintentionally that judge has spent their entire career as a prosecutor. Or vice versa, right? And so, but also you develop sort of precedent. You know, I'm not saying you write opinions all the time, but you get a track record of how you decide cases, and then people have takeaways from that. And sometimes you think the last thing you want is a judge versus a jury, but sometimes that's a great thing for your case.
Interesting. All right, yeah, we went on a little
tangent.
We went on a couple tangents.
Yeah.
Tangents on tangents.
Take us off the air now.
We will, because we got to hit a commercial break. 312-981-7200. Any questions you got for Mike Leonard? Obviously a smart dude who knows a lot about the law. 312-981-7200. We'll get to more after this on Let's Get Legal on WGN. Mike, you want to go to the phone line? You want to talk about another question?
Well, I just want to say thank you for solving my marketing problems. You just called me a smart dude, so I'm going to change my website and say I am a smart dude. It's kind of attuned to my daughter had this campaign for me years ago where she wanted me to have an owl as the logo, you know, showing that you're like wise. Yeah, I never adopted that though. It could have been huge.
It could have had a lot more business.
Yeah, but the Smart Dude campaign might be big.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to be wearing a suit on a Saturday if you had absorbed the Smart Dude stuff.
Exactly.
You want to go to the phone lines here?
Sure. Let's do it. Let's do it.
And let's make sure your headphones work. This is always a journey. Can you hear me, Mike?
I can.
There
John.
We go.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mike on line one. Mike for Mike. What's up, bud?
Yes, I have a question about the mandatory arbitration that's been sneaking in contracts for credit cards, brokerage firms, banks sometimes. Is there any, like, a state law saying that if you sign it, do you always waive your right to a jury trial if you sign that, or are you locked into mandatory arbitration? And yep. Is there a way saying you don't want to sign it because it's in there that you can get out of it or something like that?
That is a great question. That's a really good question. And it used to come up a lot. And until a few years ago, I would say...
Can you explain it like I'm 10, what we're talking about here?
So let everyone... So we're on the same page. So the example the listener just gave is one where you're signing up for a credit card or something, you know, something that you're viewing online, and you scroll through the fine print. And one of them is that you're waiving your right to a jury trial, agreeing to arbitration on all disputes. So let's say you get ripped off, or you say they breach the contract, or they don't perform, and your remedy then is arbitration. You can't go to court. You can't get a jury. So those are very common in consumer type of situations. But the ones I'm talking about, which are also becoming increasingly common, are you get a job with an employer, and you have to sign an employment agreement, and there's a mandatory arbitration provision that says, hey, all disputes between the parties, which could be anything from a breach of contract to a tort claim to an employment discrimination matter against that employer, you're waiving your right to go to court, you're waiving your right to a jury trial, and typically you're waiving the right to seek class action relief, right?
Mm-hmm.
So most employers or other contracting parties, they won't waive that. They'll say, hey, if you don't want to sign it, then too bad, right?
Right.
So for a number of years, people would go to court and attack them, and they'd say, hey, look, it should be unenforceable, it's unconscionable, or it was in the fine print, it wasn't conspicuous enough, or the jury right is so important, it shouldn't be able to be waived. But unfortunately, from my standpoint, who represents individuals, the courts have pretty much come around to that they're enforceable. You try to attack them sometimes. If you can argue that your client didn't have notice, or it was buried in a fine print, maybe that argument's not going to fly anymore.
But if every credit card company has this, and we live in a society where you have to have credit cards, how is that fair then, that you could never bring a credit card company to a trial or jury?
Well, the idea is that you're two contracting parties. Obviously, they have the upper hand on you, and that you're agreeing to it as a condition of doing business. I don't think it's fair personally, especially when you're getting rid of the jury trial, because a jury trial is already eroding, and it's not often enough had. But yeah, I don't think it's fair, but the courts have basically come around to say that absent some extraordinary circumstances that you can prove, they're generally going to uphold the enforceability of those arbitration provisions and make you arbitrate and bar you from going to court.
So to answer Mike's question, most likely there's not a way to waive that mandatory arbitration.
Yeah, I mean, once in a while you get lucky and the other party or the employer's working from some old document or something that somebody put together that doesn't make it clear what you're waiving and something like that. But those days are mostly gone.
Mike, did that answer your question?
Yes, and just a follow-up question. Is there any states that make it illegal to have that in a contract?
You know, I don't know the answer off the top of my head. You know, even the most liberal state for consumers, which is generally believed to be and is the state of California, my understanding is that generally they're enforceable even there. So if they're enforceable there, which I'm probably speaking a little bit too broadly, unlikely that most states would disagree with that. Most states would say, yeah, they're enforceable. And the federal courts have decided that, you know, under the Federal Arbitration Act, that these are enforceable. So, yeah, it's tough for consumers. It's tough for employees. It's tough for contracting parties when there's an imbalance, you know, a small party contracting with a big party. And then there's a breach, and that small party wants to sue or bring a claim, and it might be in a very imbalanced situation. The thing we didn't talk about is that oftentimes in arbitration, the parties have to share the cost. So think about that. You have a small business person or company suing a much larger one, and they're equally on the hook to pay the arbitrator's fees, which unfortunately sometimes can be tens of thousands of dollars, or if not more, and sometimes you have a panel of three. So that has to be split by the parties, which is an overwhelming obligation to someone who doesn't have a lot of money, who may
It's not based on how much your company is worth. Like no. The company that is worth $1 billion versus the company that's worth $10,000, they don't do it by that.
No, it should be. There are circumstances where you can make a showing that it's financially impossible and too onerous to shift the fees in that way or to share them. But yeah, there's situations. I'm aware of a case now that we're involved in where there's a huge disparity between the two parties' financial circumstances, and yet the argument is that both parties are equally on the hook, which is really a tragic result.
Mike, thanks for the phone call, okay?
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks, right. Mike.
That raises a lot of questions, Mike. So you're telling me a lot of employers, I'm surprised I haven't asked this about Patrick Dolan, and Gary's on the line. We'll try and get to his question after the news.
Sure.
We've only got a minute right now.
Yeah.
I want to know, I'm surprised I haven't talked about this with Patrick Dolan. I'll have to ask him about this, employment lawyer, who you know well. About, do most companies make you waive your rights to jury trials and other things?
More and more so. It's becoming increasingly common, which is...
Is that not collusion amongst companies to create an imbalance of power?
That's a good question.
Why couldn't I sue an antitrust law? Wait, no, seriously. If we have to have credit cards to survive.
Yeah, well, because they're not colluding. The idea is that, hey, here are the terms and conditions under which we're willing to do business. I mean, so the courts, unfortunately, find them to be enforceable. I don't agree with that, but I think that you and Patrick should discuss this in more detail. Maybe Patrick's listening and is going to call in.
I'd argue by having the same terms and conditions for every company, these major companies, is a collusion between these companies to take out any competition between them in that regard, that they have to have that there, that the consumer, which now we are living by credit cards, is a necessary function of civilized society. It should not be allowed that they have the exact same terms and conditions across the board.
I don't disagree with you, but they're probably not the same. But yeah, in that respect, yeah, they are the same.
I'm not a lawyer. I think that just showed.
But you play one on the radio.
I do. All right. We got Gary's got a question. We'll have to see if Mike Leonard's able to answer that. We got some other things we're going to cover, too, after the news on WGN. 312-917-2200 is our phone number. Let's go to the phone lines here. And Gary, I'll say this ahead of time. It's Mike Leonard's not a tax attorney. But Mike said, let's get the question on there, and I'm going to try and help this guy out. So, Gary, what do you got for Mike?
I took my taxes this year to the same place I took them last year. Last year was the first time I was there. Had a good experience, met the preparer, and that was a good deal. This year I walked through the front door. I say, is so-and-so here who did them last year? I had a good experience. They acknowledge and say, yes, fine. Drop them off, get the call 3 days later, go back, and I said, is he here? I'd like to talk to him. He said, oh, no, we gave him to somebody else. I said, oh, well, okay, I'll figure out the recap. What's the price? And the price had gone up 20%. Now, 20% won't kill me one way or the other. But I said, oh, I'm surprised that I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And the party says, yeah, we did not know how to communicate that to our customers. It's kind of hard to tell them when they walk in. On the other hand, we sent you a video. And so I pull out my phone and I said, I have 79 emails in the last 4 hours. It's not likely I watched the video and said, well, you should have known.
Wait. The video explains the new rate?
Right. The video of the preparer, they claim the video of the preparer said we've had a rate increase and blah, blah, blah.
That's so weird. That's weak sauce.
Is there a responsibility to communicate to the consumer so they're not blindsided? They were already done. Again, 20% won't kill me. I was just curious about the communication process.
That's a great question. So, yeah, your question is a legal one. I categorize that as weak sauce by a company to not be able just to be honest. Inflation's gone up. Sometimes things cost more. If you did a good job, Gary, you might have said, okay, well, that's still worth it for me because I had a good experience last year. Let's do it. And to say and bury it in an email with a video explaining your new prices, Mike, you tackle it from a legal perspective.
I would agree. I think it's probably... may I say intentionally weak sauce? I mean, obviously, if they only disclose it in the form of an email or in a video, it's a little suspicious in my view. Certainly, you know, it comes down to really kind of a basic question of contract law. What did the parties agree upon? You know, unfortunately, I would say, you know, someone should probably always ask what's it going to cost and get an agreement on those terms. But in this case, I don't think it was unreasonable for you to believe that, you know, that fixed cost is going to be the same. You can have a claim for potentially consumer fraud and deceptive practices under the Illinois Act, or, you know, arguably a breach of a contract. But I think the on the contract claim, you know, the argument is probably the parties never really reached an agreement on what the cost was going to be. But you could certainly make the argument it's consumer fraud because they're not making a disclosure to you that's legitimate about what it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
So, and finally, you know, John started by saying I'm not a tax attorney, but judges do find me sometimes to be taxing.
Oh, that's a good one, Mike Leonard. Very good. Gary, that is too bad. I don't know if you want to go through all that hassle. Gary, what you could probably do, honestly, to really is just try and argue with them one more time, and if not, give them one star and let other customers know that that's what they did to you. And businesses learn very quickly when they get bad reviews.
Well, yeah. Also,
Before I left the office, asked for a supervisor, communicated it just the way I did to you, and they acknowledged the same thing the front desk did. Well, we weren't quite sure how to tell people, either in the video or when they picked it up. And I said, well, even at 20%, I don't know if that's what the marketplace demands.
Right.
And I said, yeah, I'm sorry it worked out that way.
Don't be a doctor if you don't want to give. Yeah, it's like a doctor not wanting to give you a bad diagnosis and just sending it to you in an email instead. Don't do that job if you're not prepared to tell customers what the cost of something is.
Well, yeah, Gary, I'd say that statement alone would kind of keep you in play to have a claim because they're basically admitting that they didn't disclose it properly to you. It was a stupid thing to say. It's a really good admission for you. What oftentimes works in these situations, and I'm not saying I want to do this, but you know, a letter from an attorney indicating that they have violated the law sometimes is very effective to get you what you want in terms of your remedy, which is, you know, the deal you thought you had reached. So that's always something to consider.
You got a friend that's a lawyer, Gary, that would do a pro bono letter on a letterhead for you?
I have no interest. The 20%.
Okay. That's what I thought. All right, Gary, thanks for the call. Leave them a one-star review. They'll learn, okay?
Have a good day, guys.
Yeah, take care. You thank you.
Yeah, it's like that's always such an interesting debate of like you are maybe legally on sound footing, but there comes a point in time where it's like just eat the cost. But
and that's what they're banking on too, though.
Exactly,
you know, they're making this obscure disclosure.
But then you should leave a review, like those Google reviews and things like that. Like we have a lot of great clients here on WGN, and they tout their Google review of 4.9 because that means something. It really does,
no doubt. Yeah, they're not reviewing us, are they, John?
No.
Good.
You get
good,
five
good.
Stars.
I want to make sure
time.
They can't review us. So,
yeah.
Okay.
There's not a great pivot to this case. By the way, 312-981-7200, because it's a horrific case, and the killing of Elijah McClain has been covered a lot. But there's an interesting new wrinkle in what is happening in that case. Can you catch us up on what happened here?
Yeah, for some background. So Elijah McClain was a gentleman who lived in the Aurora, Colorado area. It's an August day several years ago. He's walking down the street.
23 years old.
Yeah, and it's an August day, and he's carrying a bag from like a 7-Eleven that has some, you know, a non-alcoholic drinks in there, a couple of teas or whatever. And he is wearing a ski or stocking mask because he has some medical condition. So someone calls the police and says, gee, I saw this guy walking in this location. He looks very sketchy. And, you know, they don't claim that he has a gun or has committed any criminal activity. They do claim that I think he was waving his arms at me, right? So that triggers, you know, police coming out to see what's going on, and they see this guy walking down the street, just as I sort of described. But they get out of the car, they approach him, they get physical with him rather quickly, they frisk him, then they decide to move him, as they put it, to the grass in the custody of a couple guys with a lot of force. They then put what's called a carotid artery hold on his neck, which is designed to deprive the person of oxygen and induce unconsciousness. So they do all those things. He's not dead, but it's, you know, kind of questionable from a lot of different perspectives. But then the paramedics come, and this is the case we're talking about now. So the paramedics come, and they kind of wait around for a couple minutes. They see that he's on the ground. He's really not moving. He's not being responsive. He's still alive, of course.
Is there video of all this, too?
Yeah, there's video. There's, you know, the body-worn cameras of some of the officers. So you can see that he's not dead. He's really not doing anything in response. He looks like he's on really shaky ground at that point in time. But the paramedics make the decision. They think their sort of own diagnosis from their experience is what they call excited delirium, and they decide, without speaking to Mr. McLean, without taking any vital signs or doing anything, they decide to give him a ketamine shot to his shoulder to subdue him, essentially. And a lot of people would argue, well, he didn't need to be subdued. He's already laying on the ground. But then the final factor is they misjudged. They made an estimate of what he weighed to try to do the ketamine shot, and they estimated, oh, he looks like he weighs about 190. He weighed 140, so they gave him essentially an overdose of the ketamine. And then on the way to the station, he has cardiac arrest and he dies, not immediately, but within a day or two. So some of the officers are being prosecuted for that conduct, but what made it sort of a national story was they charged the two paramedics, with criminally negligent homicide. And the reason why we're bringing all this up is there was a big sentencing hearing this week in Colorado where the first of the two paramedics was sentenced. He was found guilty.
Oh, they were found guilty of criminal negligence.
Yeah, one was found guilty already. The second one hasn't gone to trial. So the first one was found guilty of criminally negligent homicide, and I think something like second-degree assault. And he was faced anywhere up to about 26 years. The minimum he could have gotten was 5. Of course, first responders, paramedics, firefighters were making the case that these guys, even if they screwed up, were using their best judgment in their profession and were following their training. Hmm. But they still were convicted by a jury. And so the sentence happened this week and the guy got 5 years. And so that really was a national event in terms of, you know, first responders from across the country attending the sentencing, sort of sounding off about it. And a lot of different viewpoints on this case, of course, from the first responder standpoint.
Yeah, that's a very interesting one. And I'll just preface this by saying I come from a family of first responders and firefighters. So if my opinion is maybe skewed one way or another, I'm recognizing that could be a possibility why. Everything that you laid out seems egregious that would happen, right? I do worry, and I imagine this is one of the worries that the paramedics would say, is the precedent that it sets, because paramedics are often arriving on scene to a chaotic situation where they have to make snap judgments to save people's lives, and some of them may be the wrong decisions ultimately, right? The same thing happens in hospitals with doctors and surgeons in those moments. Maybe this one was more clear one way or the other, but that could maybe amp up prosecutors to start going after paramedics more. I could see the slippery slope argument that one could make about
this. Yeah, and that's the argument that, you know, firefighters, first responders, paramedics have been making. Of course, they always have to exercise judgment. So the facts in this case obviously weren't great for the paramedics in terms of the fact that they didn't do any vital signs. They didn't talk to Mr. McLean before they made the decision to do what they did. And obviously making a misjudgment on the weight was a huge error. A lot of people say, you know, that's negligence. It shouldn't be something that's criminalized. Other people would say their conduct was so reckless and they didn't take the steps they needed to take, and they're satisfied with them being charged. So there's camps on both sides of this one, that's for sure.
Well, did it come down to the weight thing is ultimately why they were found guilty, or was it the whole situation? Why even administer it in the first place?
Yeah, the whole situation. Okay. I mean, obviously the prosecution's experts questioned, why did you even do that? You had a guy laying on the ground. Even if he had been in an agitated state before, he didn't appear to be in an agitated state at the time you gave the ketamine. It didn't seem like there was any reason to do that. They weren't directed by anyone else to do that. They made that decision on their own. So that was pretty controversial to do it at all, to administer the ketamine.
Yeah, the weight thing, that's really unfortunate, but that's a tough.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Like, I think I'd be able to tell between someone 140, 190 pounds, but I don't know what they're wearing. I don't know the situation. I don't know is it nighttime? Like, I mean, there's a lot of factors in there. I worry about that, but should you do it at all or not?
Yeah, I mean,
seems like a fair debate to have.
If you change the facts, like any case, you change the facts a bit and you probably change the outcome. If they had approached him, had taken his vital signs, had spoken to him, had done other things, then they probably don't get a guilty verdict, right?
That's fair.
Yeah.
A few more minutes here with Mike Leonard. Leonard Trial Lawyers. Oh, how can people reach you, by the way, Mike?
312-380-6559.
I just have you in my phone of, if you're in trouble, call this guy.
Exactly.
I really think that should be people's numbers. Cause
sure.
State, like a better, state or federal.
Like a Better Call Saul approach, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, federal. We do more federal than state, but we still do a lot of state criminal cases as well.
What's that number again?
312-380-6559.
Okay. Just to recap, 630's texting in. We had a caller text that say they went to a tax preparer the second year. The first year was great. They didn't really disclose that the prices had gone up 20%. And they snuck it in a video in an email, which to me indicates that they knew that it was unpopular. Of course it was. I said, well, the best thing maybe to do is just leave a 1-star review. The 630 says, really, John, a 1-star review? Because they didn't communicate how much their prices were going up. Really? Was the service that bad? Fine, 2 or 3 stars. I guess what I'm saying is just leave a review so people, other people, when they're looking, go, hey, the prices either went up 20%. And I will say it's almost worse the way they did it.
Like yeah,
barely, they know it's not good news.
As we talked about offline, like they knew they were going up 20%. So, of course, they don't want to say, hey, everybody, we've just increased our rates 20%. Come on back in, right?
Right.
So let's find a way to bury it and not fully disclose.
So maybe 3 stars, whatever you want to do.
I think sometimes the threat of doing the review or taking action is enough to get you
your money back. Yeah. Exactly. 224 says, talking about the worry about if the paramedics case, like we were just talking about, there's a lot of short staffed departments across the country. What's going to happen with first responders if we start holding them accountable for an on-the-job mistake, a mistake that caused somebody's life, unfortunately, but obviously a mistake? Are we going to start losing first responders? That's part of a broader conversation, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think people would be afraid of that, right? And the argument that's been made by first responders nationally is that it'll impede our ability to do our job because we won't feel comfortable making judgment calls if we think are, you know, dangerous. And they often are dangerous because that's the nature of the job. So that is one good argument that's been made in this situation.
Because you can't criminally charge a doctor. I guess you could if it reaches a certain level of negligence. I thought there's like malpractice protections or something.
Yeah, for a doctor, like let's say your own doctor, that's usually remedied by medical malpractice lawsuit. Clearly, if the doctor was... there are cases where doctors get charged
with crime, like the sex cases and stuff like that,
where they're doing intentional assault and rape and things of that nature.
Yeah, right. Like if there's criminal action, anyone can be charged.
But their judgment is not almost never the subject of a criminal action. However, remember the Michael Jackson doctor case?
Yeah, that's right.
I think he was criminally charged.
Okay, let's go to a phone line call. Let's go to Rich. Rich, what do you got for us?
Oh, just a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Okay. Well, give us a little bit of this. That's all we have time for.
That's what we're here for.
I'll give you a little bit of this. There's no time. It's running out. The city of Chicago attorney has been placing phone calls every other day to me to try and collect on a water bill. 3 years ago, 2 cycles billing statements where I was overcharged 3 times the amount of which I paid on one and 4 times the amount on another, which I didn't pay. And a year prior to that, my average bill was $300. Since then, that was 3 years ago, my average has still been $300. So they wanted a $2,000 charge for 2 billing cycles.
Yeah, you're saying you were overcharged and you didn't want to pay it all, so you haven't, but now they want that money.
Now they want that money, and if I call the attorney's office, is there a chance of settling? I'm willing to pay the average or the mean of what I was paying in the years leading up to this and since then,
right?
Which has been like $300 a month, and I'll pay $600.
I got you, Rich. I want to get an answer.
I got you.
Look, Mike, I want to give time for Mike to answer.
Oh, yeah. There's always a possibility of settlement, especially. They haven't brought an actual civil case against you, have they?
No.
Yeah, and the reason why you'd have optimism about settling is because it's certainly not worth it financially for them to sue you.
Right.
Even in small claims court. So there's always a room to try to settle, and you should try to settle. Why not? What's there to lose?
Yeah, why don't you just say, I'll pay this much and see what the lawyer says, and then call us next week when Mike's on, see what they say.
But make sure you sign a settlement agreement release so that they can't come after you. So make sure it's documented, yeah.
Don't offer my credit card over the phone. Get a release first.
Right.
Exactly. But yeah, of course, you could have the expectation that you could settle because it doesn't make any sense. They're probably very unlikely to sue you, and it wouldn't make financial sense for them to do so.
Rich, can you...
And if I use my credit card, I wouldn't get a jury trial.
There you go.
Right, exactly.
Well, no, that's just your just your dispute with the consumer with the credit card company.
Rich was making a joke, Mike.
I know.
He got it.
I know.
Rich,
I'm slow. I'm slow.
Call the lawyers. Mike's on next week. I want to hear how it goes, okay?
Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Call back again. Mike Leonard, we're out of time. Where can people reach you at again?
312-380-6559, Leonard Trial Lawyers.
And I think Iridian is talking to Tim, maybe to get Stephen A. Leahy's number or something like that to get a tax question. And next week, you and Patrick Dolan, sometimes we split you up 1 hour each. We're going to have 2 hours of a whole show of just anyone's calls on legal grab bag.
And Dolan and I are going to go mano a mano. So I hope he's listening because he better be boning up on the law. Okay?
I'm sure he is.
You hear that, Dolan?
I think he's on vacation. Okay. Mike Leonard, good to talk to you, my friend.
Thanks, buddy.